Hello everybody, welcome and kumusta. Thank you for joining me. This is How Your Occupational Therapist, and welcome to Occupational Therapy Conversations. In this episode of Occupational Therapy Conversations, I'd like us to have a discussion about muscles, or a muscle contraction to be particular. I've just been ruminating about these muscle contraction because I don't know if there's a lot of therapists out there who knows a good detail about it. Because every time I would go and observe some therapy sessions, everything is all about just getting the person out of bed, standing and walking and doing some passive stretching, doing some exercises, doing some range of motions. And if people are in critical care, for example, they get people to move. And then there's a lot of worries about this thing called, what do you call this? These post-intensive care syndrome, where there is a lot of weakness. And I noticed that to a lot of people, it seems to be a mystery. But it really isn't if we understand the muscle. So what do we know about the muscle? What is the basic unit of muscle? So that is a trivia question number one. What is the basic unit of a muscle? The basic unit is called a sarcomere. And what are the key points about this? It is the structural and the foundation unit of a striated muscle. And when we're talking about striated muscle, these are muscles that has streaks. So you have three types. You have the cardiac muscle, you have a skeletal muscle, and also you have a smooth muscle. So we're not going to talk about smooth muscles because that has little to do with us therapists. And the cardiac muscle, it's there, but we cannot control it. The one that we can control would be the skeletal muscle, and that is striated muscles. And these are muscles that has striations, yeah? And it's called sarcomere, the basic unit of a muscle. A single muscle cell is called the sarcomere. And this sarcomere is a segment between these two Z discs or Z lines. And a sarcomere is composed of two filaments, the thin and the thick filaments. The thin filament is called the actin, and then the thick filament is called a myosin. Yeah, just remember, myo would be a Latin for muscle, M-Y-O. It's a medical Latin. So every time M-Y, that stands for muscles. So actin and myosin. And what happens here is that it slides past each other during a muscle contraction. So whenever the muscles are shortening, and you begin to think, why does it shorten and how does it shorten? It has to do with this actin and myosin sliding onto each other. And I did mention that sarcomeres have a thin and the thick filaments. These repeating sarcomeres along the muscle fiber, it's giving a striated appearance, and it just becomes visible to the eye much better because of these, the different shades or the different thickness. And it being repeated all throughout will give it a striated appearance. And the coordinated contraction of sarcomeres will shorten the entire muscle fiber, and it will produce the movement. Now, let us have a conversation about the process of muscle contraction. This is a little bit complicated, and it's so difficult to explain this without having to draw it, but bear with me. Try and visualize it, okay? So the process of muscle contraction is a theory. And the theory behind this is a sliding filament theory. So you have two filaments, the thin and the thick, and it slides to one another. So that is that. I don't know. There's high technology nowadays, but I've never looked into it in details. But it's the well-known and established theory on how muscles contract. Yeah. So the sliding filament theory, it involves a few steps. These steps convert the nerve impulse into movement. And let's talk about that. It all starts with nerve stimulation and excitation. So how does this work? Every muscle contraction starts with a nerve stimulation. So a motor neuron, which would be a nerve that has something to do with movement, and that is called a motor neuron, it will release a neurotransmitter, acetylcholine. And this acetylcholine, so it's a chemical. A neurotransmitter is a chemical. Acetylcholine will then get onto the end of the nerve towards the junction of the muscle, right? And this is called the neuromuscular junction. So motor neuron will fire electrical impulses, and this neurotransmitter, which are chemicals, right, will be taken from the nerve, and it will take it all the way down to the junction where the nerve meets the muscle, and that is the neuromuscular junction. Then what happens, these acetylcholine will bind to a receptor on the muscle fiber's sarcolemma. And from the nerves, these acetylcholine transmits to the muscle itself. And once these acetylcholine goes into the sarcolemma, which is the muscle itself, it will trigger electrical signal or an action potential, meaning there is a change of electric polarity. It's like a robot, guys. It's like a battery. So it does that. It goes all the way. It triggers an action potential. So that's the first one. Nerve stimulation, that's the first step. The next step is what you call excitation-contraction coupling. And in here, this action potential then, so there is a lot of charge and there's a potential to move now because of these acetylcholine. This action potential will travel along the sarcolemma. And this is the area, the surface area of the muscle. And it goes down to a T-tubules. And what happens when this action potential then travels to the T-tubules, it will stimulate the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And when this action potential stimulates this sarcoplasmic reticulum, it then releases calcium ion into the sarcoplasm. Yeah, it's like sarco is actually a Greek for muscle, okay? Myo is Latin for muscle. So sarcoplasm, meaning it's like ectoplasm. So plasm is like the area, plasma. The calcium will be in the sarcoplasm. That is the next step. The third step is the calcium binding and troponin activation. And what happens? So electrical impulse goes into the muscle, and then the muscle, there is an action potential, and it goes in and travel into the T-tubules, it's called, and then it stimulates the sarcoplasmic reticulum, the one that holds these calcium ions, and now the calcium ions is now on the sarcoplasm. Yeah. Now, once the sarcoplasm, the calcium has been released, the calcium then will bind into the troponin. And troponin is actually a regulatory protein on the actin, which is the thin filament. So the calcium will bind into the actin. And what happens, there's some mechanism that's happening in there. Just think of it that once that happens, the tropomyosin will shift and it exposes these myosin binding sites on the actin, okay? It's like a robot. Something turns, so that for some reason, this calcium will open up something. So a calcium ion will just open something. And this is where a potential area to myosin binding sites on the actin. So the actin would be the thin filaments. There are some myosin binding sites. So that's the third step. Okay. Now the fourth step after that, so these myosin binding sites were exposed. Now there's going to be a cross bridge formation. And what it is, the myosin heads and the myosin, if you remember, these are from the thick filament, will the myosin heads will bind now to the exposed sites on the actin. And then it will form a bridge, just like ropes. So from the thick filament, there are bridges that will reach out to that exposed binding site on the thin filament. And that's it. It's formed cross bridges. And when that happens, when there is that binding, the ATP, which is adenosine triphosphate, is used. So energy is used to, quote-unquote, cock this myosin head into a high-energy state before it binds. Yeah, so it will just go and stimulate this myosin heads, and it forms the cross bridge. And when that happens, there has to be an energy, ATP. Again, chemicals, guys. ATP, chemicals. And then that's the fourth stage. Now, on the fifth stage is now the power stroke. And with the power stroke, the myosin then will pull. Myosin being the thick filaments will now pull this actin filaments, and it pulls it towards the center of the muscle, the sarcomere. And when it pulls it, the muscle shortens. Yeah. And when that happens, the muscle shortens, yeah? Now, on to the sixth stage, another ATP will bind into the myosin head. So once it shortens, ATP, again, a chemical, will bind into that myosin head, and then it will cause it to detach from the actin. And then this ATP, once it does that, it gets hydrolyzed and it gets broken into these ADP and PI. So it splits. You break the ATP. Okay. Every energy. So the breaking down of ATP will cause an ADP and PI. And if you're wondering what this ADP and PI stands for, this is adenosine diphosphate. Yeah. And then the PI would be an inorganic phosphate, yeah? And so remember, ATP is adenosine triphosphate, yeah? And then every time that there is an energy expenditure, it breaks down and it becomes into a diphosphate and then inorganic phosphate. So it takes away energy, yeah? So these are the products of, when you break this thing down, it's called, the process is hydrolysis, yeah? And hydro being water, lysis is destruction, okay? So that's just to clarify that part, okay? So there we go. That is now the detachment. And because now these myosin head now just got detached from the actin, okay, the next step is now where there's going to be a relaxation. And in relaxation, when these nerve signals stop, yeah, the calcium is pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and then the troponin returns to its original shape, and now it will then, the tropomyosin will then block the myosin sites in the other muscle again, and it actually closes it. So what's important here is the calcium. So with the relaxation is, once it's back, it closes whatever it is where these actin and myosin, the myosin heads, where it attaches, it's closing that attachment site. So without the calcium, there will be no cross bridges, and the muscle relaxes, right? So imagine a constant contraction of the muscle, constant contraction or effort, constant effort of the muscle, or constant effort of the person, the will, for some reason, these are nerve signals. The will, the motor neuron, will create nerve signals which will release acetylcholine, will go into the neuromuscular junction, it will stimulate the muscle, it will release a calcium, this calcium will open up a binding site, and then there's going to be a cross bridge, and when that cross bridge happens, there will be energy will be spent, yeah? And then after that, when there is no more will and when everything relaxes now, there's no more calcium, there's no more stimulation, then the calcium will be released and that will let things go. That cross bridge will let go. It closes again and the muscle relaxes, okay? And every time there is a contraction, the adenosine triphosphate breaks down into adenosine diphosphate and a free-floating phosphate. Okay? Wow. So some important chemicals in here. The will. Well, chemicals is acetylcholine and calcium. All right? So that's one. These are chemicals now. The nerves stimulates these things. Now, how relevant is this to muscle weakness? Yeah. So muscle weakness will happen, number one, if there is a nerve signal problem. And this is a weakness that is caused by a neurological weakness. So there is no signal coming from the nerves. Stroke will do this because there is no electrical impulse. In some conditions where the motor neuron is impaired, the motor neuron cannot release acetylcholine or it cannot transmit the signal. And an example of the conditions for this one would be a condition called myasthenia gravis. Myasthenia gravis is a condition where the autoimmune attacks on the acetylcholine receptors in the muscle. Yeah. So myo, like I said, myo is muscle. Asthenia would have been development, so muscle wasting. Gravis is like severe muscle wasting because there's no muscle contraction. Yeah. And when there is no nerve signals, what's going to be the result? The muscle fibers are not activated. And when they are not activated, it will cause weakness. So that is one cause of muscle weakness. The second one is if there is an excitation contraction coupling failures, meaning the excitation, so acetylcholine comes in, the calcium release is next. That's the one thing that needs to happen. If that is impaired, the calcium release from the sarcoplasmic reticulum will mean, if there is a problem there, it means that the actin and the myosin interaction cannot begin. So what conditions do we have here? When somebody has a hyperthermia, or a central core disease, for example, so even if there is acetylcholine, but there is a problem with the release of muscle, if there is a problem where there is no release of calcium or this impairment in terms of calcium getting into the sarcoplasmic reticulum, it will then obviously result on a weak or no muscle contraction. That's the second reason. The third reason would be if there is a cross bridge problems, meaning if the actin or the myosin itself is structurally abnormal or they are missing. And this happens on conditions like muscular dystrophies, for example. And muscular dystrophy is muscle. This is difficulty trophesis formation. So by definition of these condition, it's muscular dystrophy is a condition that stops development of muscle. And cross bridge problems, what are the examples? Duchenne muscular dystrophy. So they're missing this dystrophin and it affects the entire contraction. So there are chemicals, yes, but these cross bridges, it doesn't happen. It is impaired. It's structurally abnormal. And obviously the result is there's going to be weakness in there, right? The fourth reason is there is a deficiency with adenosine triphosphate. So no, if there's no ATP, meaning the myosin heads cannot release or cannot recock, and there is no sustained contraction. And if there's no sustained contraction, an example, some conditions would be a mitochondrial myopathy or severe malnutrition. Yeah. Mitochondria, these are all the powerhouses. These are the chemicals or the powerhouse of the cell. They're the ones that cooks things. And if there are some problems there or there is malnutrition, there is no adenosine triphosphate, yeah, the result would be fatigue, muscle weakness on exertion. There we go. And the fifth reason is if there is a structural damage to the muscle fiber. And obviously, the muscle fiber, once it's damaged, the sarcomere, there will be a disruption on the cytoskeleton, and it will interfere with the force of transmission. When the muscle is damaged itself, it cannot contract in the proper way. Yeah. So what happens? What conditions? Myopathies. Yes, myo muscle pathesis condition. Okay, inflammatory type. Yeah. Those conditions that inflames the muscle. Trauma, injury, chronic overuse. Again, it will result in muscle weakness, even if the nerves are intact, even if the signals are intact, even if the calcium cells are there, even if there is energy. If the muscles are impaired, then you can't do it. Then the next and final reason why there would be a muscle weakness is because of a disuse, and it will lead to atrophy. Yeah? Why? If the muscles are not used, particularly after immobilization because of a chronic problem, what's happening? So the muscles are weak. It has a little chance of producing or synthesizing protein. That's one. The sarcomere itself, the quality will degrade. That's two. What else happens when you have muscle atrophy? There is a decay of the mitochondria. Yeah? Mitochondrial decay. And when these things happen, a person will be weak. They'll get easily tired. Yeah? So how do you build the muscles? It takes a long time. It's not like a bone that you can easily switch on. It takes weeks and months and proper nutrition before it builds itself. Yeah. I keep going back to this analogy called it's easier to be bad than to be good. And this happens either literally and metaphorically. When the muscles, it's easier to get weaker. But once you have the muscles have atrophied, then there is no synthesis of protein. There's mitochondrial delay. How long will it take before that comes back? Obviously, the result would be severe weakness and muscle fatigue. Okay? Ooh, that is a little bit intense, isn't it? And this is only muscles, guys. So what can we do? I think preventative therapy is the best way on how to prevent this. In my observation, particularly for those patients who are in critical care, for example, when they're in critical care, everything has gone, a person has gone severely weak because we have not done anything. I know the person is not doing something and they can't do something. They are sick. They are ill. Okay? Is it then that we need to do something to help them, to supplement the things that they cannot do? If we have ECMO supplementing the function of the lungs, and if we have VADs, ventricular assistive devices, that are there to help the function of the heart, and if we are using devices like dialysis machine to do the function of the kidney, what are we doing to supplement the function of the muscles? And I can think of a few things. The most primitive way is through manual stimulation. We need to get those muscles moving. And manual stimulation is, I would call it proprioceptive stimulation. But a tool of the trade of, say, physical therapist and physiotherapist is massage. It's always been, and for a long time, I think in the 17th or 18th century, there's already the association of massage therapists because it helps. But people don't want to be called as massage therapists nowadays. So that's one. Manual stimulation. Regular manual stimulation. Yeah. You keep stimulating the muscles. That's one. And the thing is, when somebody is in bed, here's the challenge. When somebody is in bed, you can only stimulate those that you can access. You know, the upper limb, that's fine. The legs, yes, you can do that. But then the one thing that we are not stimulating are these wide muscles in the back. Yeah? So one way of stimulating them is through the use of manual activities, through deep pressure, through vibratory input, okay? Tapping, vibration, stretching, because you're stimulating the muscle spindles. When you stimulate the muscle spindles one way or another, these are all stimulating the nerves. These are stimulating the nerves, efferent fibers, afferent fibers. Yeah. And when there is a contraction in there, I'm sure it will hopefully get these acetylcholines out. So that's one way of stimulating it, right? Another way of stimulating the muscles is through gravity. And the body alone, the weight of the body alone, is actually a resistance already. That's why getting a person upright is good. But if the person can't do it, and it's taking a long time for people to get the person out, and because it's taking a long time, people has less patience. So sitting them up for 5 minutes is really not going to crack it. We need to use gravity, and that is getting the person in an upright position, changing the position. So the upright position, how do you best do that? Use of tilt table. Regularly do that. That's one, okay? And what else? So tilt table will do that. And if they are sitting down and you want to stimulate, you have one way to stimulate this is through reflexes, and reflexes will produce a stimulation on the nerves. And these nerves are stimulated via the vestibular subsystem in the presence of a writing reflex or a writing reaction. So neck writing, optical writing, these are all 6 months to 10 months old. A child is already has developed this. So this is on the midbrain level, right? Brainstem, midbrain is where it's integrated. The protective extension, these are all cortical reflexes. But any reflexes, be it spinal reflex, it's stimulating the muscles. So stimulate those spinal reflexes, stimulate those brainstem, and then midbrain reflexes. And we can talk about that. Maybe I've done an episode of that, but I can't remember now. I'm down to 151 episodes. So it's there. So stimulation is one. Use of manual therapy. But what's stopping us from doing it? Time. People would always make an excuse of time. Okay, but if we want to do what's done, what about mechanical stimulators? Are there something out there? I loved it when it comes to the stroke and these IPC sleeves. I loved it when it came out because I would use that to stimulate somebody else's arm rather than just the thrombosis or the leg. And it's beautiful because it just stimulates it. You just turn it on and it just does its job. Yeah, and it stops a person from doing the manual therapy. The good thing about manual therapy is that the therapist can zero in and stimulate those actual muscles, and you can really take your time doing that. Okay, what else? Is there anything else? So mechanically, so we're talking about muscles, so therefore we can use mechanical aids. And can we use auditory stimulation for this? High pitch will cause more alertness, and when it may tense up somebody else's muscle, but very on a minute level, temperature will stimulate, you know, use of temperature, a colder temperature will hopefully facilitate more muscle contraction. And a warmer temperature will make the muscles relax a bit more, okay? And vibration, obviously, deep pressure. There you go. Visually, the brighter the light is, but it's linked into alertness. But if somebody is not alert and they're in critical care, then Perhaps you can stimulate them on the auditory, but it's all going to be passive. So we'll have to do something about that. Okay, guys? I'm an occupational therapist, and this is a part of my training, and I've not been trained in this country. It's always important to know physiology. Thank you. This podcast is giving me an opportunity to look into things, review into things, just going back to the basics. And that's proper basics, isn't it? Yeah. I miss this. The actin, the myosin, the actin, myosin, the monofilaments, and the calcium. It's a straightforward, wonderful thing. All right, guys. There we go. I hope this conversation is enlightening. If you like it, talk to your friends about it. Learn together and grow together. Like, share, subscribe, do what you can to appease the algorithm. Just remember, anything you do matters and has an outcome. Until next time, guys. Bye.